You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Anila. How are you?
Hi, Toby. I'm okay. We're actually without Annie this week, so I'm going to try my hardest to fill in for her by providing our weekly weather update, which is obviously why everyone listens to Solidarity Breakfast.
You're on Solidarity Breakfast, of course, 3CR, your community radio.
And yeah, the weather report, it's cold. Is that thorough enough?
The cold snap is here, signifying it's going to get warm soon.
And a classic hopefully Melbourne turn of events, giving us one taste of a day that's nice enough to enjoy and then taking it away immediately. Anyway, on to serious business. So despite the ceasefire in Gaza taking effect on October 11th, Israeli forces have killed at least 3 civilians. Gaza's health ministry has reported that since the ceasefire went into effect, 23 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli attacks and 122 have been wounded.
Yeah. The scary stuff doesn't end there. Dropsite News has a little report about how in the immediate aftermath of the Donald Trump's announcement on Thursday, there was rampant arson attacks by the IDF with... Dropsite News reporting that the destruction of Palestinian structures following the departure of soldiers who had used them as temporary bases has been a hallmark of Israel's approach to Gaza for 2 years. In July, reporter Yuval Abraham collected testimonies from soldiers describing a myriad of arson methods. Quoting one of the soldiers, "Every Arab house we entered had olive oil. We poured the oil on the sofas, on anything flammable in the apartment, and then we ignited it or threw in a smoke grenade. This was common practice."
And I think for me, it makes it abundantly clear that reporting this week from, you know, major news outlets, the Washington Post, you know, even Foreign Policy magazine and things like that have been talking about the success of the ceasefire, and that, you know, does not seem to be the case. It does not seem to have actually protected Palestinians from Israeli violence.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not...
Which could have been predicted, but...
Yeah, and it's not without... Like, if you just listen to what they're saying on Israeli channels, it doesn't take that much investigating to hear what they said. Government Minister Gila Kamliel told their Channel 7 News that we have already completely annihilated 75% of the entire Gaza Strip. There remains 25, which, as you know it too, we are taking over the city of Gaza. There will be nothing left there that would have really... the potential to be habitable. This is what they're saying on their major news channels.
Yeah, and wow.
Since the peace talks, the ceasefire, the whatever you want to call it, there's been almost no reporting of anything like this on our news. I've been keeping up to date with some of the mainstream news, which is nauseating at best, but there's really nothing of this sort of thing. They say... Hamas is not keeping up with their side of the bargains, which we already know is not true because Israel has announced that it will only be letting half of the trucks that it's promised in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been stymieing any of the aid getting in through Rafah crossing and making trucks go to Kerem Shalom to be inspected before entering.
Mm. And I think the other thing that's worth pointing out is that obviously violence in Gaza and Israel's violence in the region isn't contained to Gaza. We've seen more violence kind of cropping up in the West Bank, also intensification of bombings in Lebanon. So I think it's, yeah, probably worth pointing out that a lot of mainstream media is trying to, I guess, use the ceasefire as a reason to suggest that violence in the region perpetrated by Israel is over, it's not happening anymore, but in lots of parts of the region, it's actually increasing.
Yeah, with some crazy stories cropping out of the West Bank of settlers stealing children out of their home, and even just 3 hours ago, there was an update of an 11-year-old child being injured and dying from his injuries in the crossfire of an Israeli raid into the West Bank.
Mm, it's just shocking. And, you know, in other imperialist news, we've also had last week, following our Saturday show last week, the announcement of this year's Nobel Peace Prize recipient, Maria Corina Machado from Venezuela, who is the kind of so-called democratic leader in exile. People very understandably, you know, scratching their heads at the idea that a political leader who's aligned herself significantly with the Trump regime has been really supportive of American intervention into Venezuela is being awarded, you know, the highest accolade in peace.
Yeah, especially with those really, did you see those really weird kind of like behind the scenes Nobel Peace Prize where they were saying, oh, we would never give it to Trump, the videos where they were like, we'd never give it to Trump. But then they give it to Machado and then pretty much straight after Trump says, oh, this, they did it for me.
And she dedicated it to him, so he's probably not too far off.
Yeah. I mean, so they're telling you as plain as day, and it's kind of, what's this effect of, you know, it's kind of like playing both games, like, oh, we seem perfectly fine and normal because we're never going to give it to him. But then actually,
as long as you strap, you slap the label democratic on something, it's definitely democratic. But I think on that note, we've got a few headlines out of Venezuela this week. So U.S. intervention in Venezuela has escalated. Another vessel was struck by U.S. forces on Tuesday, marking the fifth strike on an alleged drug trafficking vessel. It's worth pointing out, no evidence has been produced that any of these vessels have any links to drug trafficking. I think it's also worth pointing out that as a result of that lack of evidence, these are essentially extrajudicial executions of random civilians, which is pretty concerning. And the Pentagon has announced that Admiral Alvin Hosley, who's the head of US or was the head of US Southern Command and the officer overseeing US escalations in the Caribbean, will be stepping down after he raised concerns about the US military mission in the Caribbean. This followed President Donald Trump's authorization earlier this week of the CIA to conduct lethal covert action in Venezuela. So the idea that strikes and military action being taken within Venezuelan land territories is appearing to be more likely than ever.
And I mean, we had the news here recently that off the coast of the Solomon Islands, they found a narcos trafficking sub, and you can see photos of what that looks like. It does not look like any of the footage that gets released from Venezuela, where has 14 crew members on board of some old fishing boat wreck. These are not like, well, we can't say with any
certainty,
yeah. But they did certainly don't look, you know, like drug smuggling vessels.
And the point is, like, you're actually supposed to have a pretty high burden of proof before you murder people.
Yeah.
Like, killing people as a result of alleged crimes usually requires some evidence. But I think for me, one of the most telling things that I've come across this week in terms of the kind of drug trafficking allegations being essentially a pretext for having greater influence over Venezuelan government, particularly in order to capture Venezuelan resources and minerals and things like that, especially oil.
Oil, crazy how that happens.
Yeah, who would have thought? But so this week I came across an interesting bit of reporting that was discussing the fact that, you know, the largest number of overdoses in the US are actually primarily caused by fentanyl, which does not come out of Venezuela or travel through the country on its way to the US. So it's a pretty flimsy pretext at that.
Yeah, and this comes off the back of some of the most crushing sanctions outside of Cuba that the US has placed on Venezuela. There's a report by Vijay Prashad on his tricontinental, I'm trying to think, it's called Global South Insights, and he released, along with the work of a bunch of researchers, a pretty comprehensive dossier talking about how intense the sanctions have been for Venezuela, and how much it is the fact that they've not been allowed a refinery in their country. So they have crude oil, but they actually have no way of refining the crude oil. So
I think this is a really great moment to point out that an exemption was given to, I think it was Chevron, for them to be able to continue. I don't know the technical term for it, but continuing to access and sell oil from Venezuela. So I think, you know, I think the motivations for wanting to get heavily involved in Venezuela are transparently far from being supportive of a democratic regime. And I think that it's probably worth bringing it back to our discussion of Nobel Peace Prize recipient
Machado.
I'm getting her mixed up with Maduro. Their names are too similar. Yeah. So she, you know, is very overtly interested in privatizing Venezuelan natural resources. She has strong ties to the US. She's got a strong relationship, reportedly, with Marco Rubio. She also attended Yale. So it seems, yeah, pretty uncontroversial to suggest that she would be in support of a particularly strong pro-capital, pro-US regime in Venezuela. And as we were talking about off-air, Toby, you know, there's a large grassroots pushback against the Maduro regime. There's a lot of desperation to see an improvement of conditions in Venezuela, economic conditions, and in terms of civil rights and things like that. And the US and Machado are capitalizing off of that desperation to provide a US intervention as an attractive alternative.
Well, she presents the perfect neoliberal fairy tale.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
The American taught progressive seeming civil liberty,
and she's a woman,
white woman, white presenting woman. Yeah, she's neoliberal wet dream.
So yeah, the idea that she's kind of, you know, the best option for a desperate Venezuelan public, who may or may not need the military support of the US, when clearly her rising to power is going to look like poor and vulnerable Venezuelans being, you know, having less of a safety net, Venezuelan wealth being offshored. It's just absolutely not apparent to the degree that Western media is presenting it that she would be a suitable alternative to anything that is currently going on with Venezuela's government.
And it's funny, like, you were saying it mirrored, like, you know, their names are very similar. It kind of reminds me a bit of the Suharto Sukarno in Indonesia, because this is kind of a similar thing. This is Machado was running on a platform that's dubbed popular capitalism, which is obviously Chilean dictator Pinochet's platform of sweeping neoliberal reforms. And actually, it's to say that, even under such crazy siege like embargoes that Venezuela is, this moment is galvanizing people with massive public support for public defense training and war readiness in case of an invasion. So even people that were maybe Maduro skeptical or didn't like what was happening, or the economic conditions under Maduro have, like, a lot of people are stepping up in defense of the country. So, I mean, this to say that we're here reporting to say that there should be no war, and we should advocate for no US intervention, especially as we continue to sign on to AUKUS, which reveals itself more and more as Australia just opening itself up to nuclear waste dumping.
And, you know, sorry to interrupt that beautiful segue. Just before we move on from Venezuela to AUKUS, I'll just mention quickly that it's been pretty well established in multiple studies that sanctions can often actually lead to more fatalities than violent war in some instances. So I think also in the case of Venezuela, talking about having a commitment to peace in that region, I think it's also important to point out that it's incredibly destructive and violent towards especially poor, vulnerable people to have really rigid sanctions on a country to the degree that Venezuela is experiencing sanctions. But anyway, on to AUKUS. I think you were going to make a point about potential costs of waste from AUKUS in Australia.
Yeah, Michael West Media just released, their journalist Rex Patrick just released a really short report after Michael West Media filed a Freedom of Information request about what the cost estimates for a solution for the treatment and storage of high-level radioactive waste from AUKUS would be. This week saw Greens and Liberals vote against Labor's policy to reform the Freedom of Information Act, which would have seen less access to more sensitive data, but that was thrown out as unconstitutional.
Yeah, worth pointing out here, like, you know, we are the people funding this. We are the people who will be paying for, you know, waste cleanup in the case of AUKUS. So we do have a right to know what we're paying for.
Yeah, absolutely. And the scariest thing is that the Defence Industry Freedom of Information decision maker responded saying that they had sourced only one document that in the section that Michael West Media has highlighted says the conditionally exempted information under Section 47C of the Freedom of Information Act concerns cost estimates for a multi-decade program that are still immature. The information is part of ongoing deliberations that have yet to be finalized or endorsed and thus subject to change. And then in a further section says that there is a strong public interest in not releasing the information.
Okay.
Pretty crazy stuff, yes, to be saying about multi-billion dollar programs.
Yes, crazy. I thought also it would be worth putting some positive news on our agenda.
Much needed.
I'm trying to think if it's too early in the morning to think of words. Put some positive information into your brains. That's what I'm trying to say. So in New South Wales, the Supreme Court has ruled on Thursday that the Labor government in New South Wales proposed anti-protest laws are unconstitutional. Who would have thought? The proposed amendments of the law enforcement powers and Responsibilities Act is what I'm trying to say, 2002, it's not passing the legal test.
Yeah.
That amendment would have included the addition of clauses prohibiting protests near places of worship. So obviously impactful on, weekly Palestinian protests.
Not weekly anymore. They've been paused in light of the ceasefire being announced. But then tomorrow there is the anti-racist rally.
Okay, good to know. Well, I expect to see some of our listeners there. You heard it here first. So the presiding judge over the case, Justice Anna Mitchell Moore, described the amendments as, quote, impermissibly burdening the implied constitutional freedom of Australians' political expression. So good to see that sometimes legal justice does play out.
And there's a lot. There's a like, yeah, we say a lot of the doom and gloom, but there is a lot to be hopeful for. We'll hear from Vivian Langford has recorded for us some of the rally speeches from the October the 12th rally in Sydney, and we'll hear from Global Samud Flotilla participant Abu Bakr Rafiq, who was on there giving his recount of what was happening. You can listen to more of Vivian's reporting on the Climate Action Show at 5 p.m. on Mondays, always on 3CR.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Peace upon you all. My name is Abu Bakr. I was one of the participants on the Global Samud Flotilla. A non-violent mission made up of 496 ordinary civilians from 46 different countries that were doing what our government should have done, and that was to break the siege on Gaza. I just landed on Friday morning, so I apologize. I haven't prepared anything. I've been trying to get some rest and trying to recover after a, I guess, difficult journey. But there is a few things that I want to highlight. Firstly, I want to thank you all so much for the love, support, solidarity that you guys showed to try to get us out of those prisons, to try to free us from being kidnapped. This just shows we are community, we have a heart, and nothing can change that. They stole all my belongings, but what they didn't know is I have a community back home that is worth way more than everything that they stole. When I first arrived to prison, I was thrown into a cage 4 by 6 meters with 83 other men. I was unaware of where I was. They refused to tell us. So I took this as an opportunity to look outside the cage and see, is there anything, any sign that could tell me where I was? There was nothing. But in the distance, I saw 3 police officers holding 2 Palestinians, hands chained, feet chained, blindfolded. They were being escorted to, I have no idea. And when I was released out of prison, I was so happy. But I thought, I've been freed, but what about those 2 Palestinians that I saw at the same time that I was brought to prison? I was freed alongside the other activists, but what about the 10,000 Palestinian hostages that are being held in prisons? Innocent mothers, innocent children, innocent fathers that have been stripped of their right of humanity, that have been stripped of everything. And our government is complicit in every one of these acts.
Shame!
Penny Wong.
Shame!
There's a lot of children, so I'll keep it PG. But she had the audacity to say, we manufacture non-lethal parts for the F-45.
Baby killers!
And this was being played on repeat in my mind while I was in prison. Why? Because we were only 20 kilometers away from Gaza. We had no access to a clock, but I knew when it was midnight. Why? Because as soon as midnight struck, we had dozens of fighter jets flying over our prison, making their way to Gaza to destroy innocent lives, to destroy Gaza. Yet, she has the audacity to say we are manufacturing non-lethal parts.
Liar!
What non-lethal part is there of an F-45, of a fighter jet?
Liar!
We are manufacturing weapons that are taking the lives of innocent children. This will always be Australia's history, a history of supporting genocide of the Aboriginal people, a history of supporting the genocide of the Palestinian people that had time and time and time and time again to prove their humanity. They had time and time and time again to change their views, but they were comfortable. They are comfortable standing there with their hands covered in the blood of the Palestinians. So we'll continue our fight. Palestine is not free. Palestine is still occupied. Palestine is still under apartheid. 10,000 Palestinians are still being held hostage. So we'll continue our fight. And I just want to end with one final thing. Talking here today really does mean a lot to me. And the reason I say this is because in prison, we were humiliated, we were tortured, we were abused, I was kicked, I was slapped, I was humiliated. And they did this with the goal that I will come home and I remain silent. But to those IDF soldiers, to those Israeli soldiers,
coward!
To those Israeli prisoners,
coward!
That thought they could silence us, look now, we will never be silent. They thought they could use their violence and their terrorism against us to place fear in our hearts, to scare us. But let me tell you something. Do not allow yourself to be scared. Do not allow them to place fear in your heart, because there is nothing to fear when you're on the right side of history. Free Palestine!
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
We'll be right back.
Hello, you're on Solidarity Breakfast with Anila and Toby. Now, a bit of a change of pace from our discussions about international relations. We're coming back home and talking about the climate and the environment.
Just so, before, if you are interested in that amazing Ethiopian cover of War Pigs, that was a band called You Can Dance. It's a crazy. They're like got saxophones. It's a big band, but they do all old rock and roll and heavy metal covers.
Amazing. So, Toby, did you want to start us off by having a bit of a chat about some of the concerns that have been raised by local environmental groups about upcoming proposed or planned burnings in Snowy National Park?
Yeah, so from the desk of GECO, which is the Goongra Environment Centre, they released a little report on what they claim the burning industry being out of control, saying that the Forest Fire Management Victoria are preparing to burn 60,000 hectares inside the Snowy National Park. They give a bit of a comparison to show just how big that is. So they say that it's bigger than the entire size of Wilson's Promontory National Park, which is pretty scary to think that it's that big, and they are saying that it's not in line with what some of these sensitive environments need, that there are a lot of really sensitive, rare bits of East Gippsland rainforest that are actually under threat here, and that they're not the forests that contribute to fuel load when it does come to fire season.
And I think also, you know, I think most ecologists and also members of Indigenous communities recognise the role that burnings can play in maintaining a healthy ecosystem. But the problem seems to be, and this is something that has been raised by other ecologists outside of the work that GECO is doing, that there is mismanagement occurring around the frequency of burnings and which sites are being chosen to conduct burnings in, at the kind of cost of damaging biodiversity. So after the bushfires in 2020, there was actually a bit of a review done of the effects of planned burnings on biodiversity following bushfire. And it was found that parts of Australia, or parts of the bush that had frequent burnings, so three or more fires in the last 40 years before the 2020 bushfire season, had a negative impact on biodiversity 87 to 93% larger than areas that had only burnt once or not at all in the same period. And so some of these reports have been suggesting that currently we have burning management that tends to have burns every 6 to 8 years, and it seems like, you know, a more responsible use of burning as a management tool would be a window of 10 to 20 years. So I think there have been a few different parts of the environmental and ecological kind of community in Australia that have been suggesting that we need to have a bit of a rethink about how we're applying planned burnings as a bushfire management strategy.
Yeah, and I mean, everyone does the acknowledgement of country, but just seems silly that no one actually ask them what would be appropriate, really.
Well, I think that some of the bushfire and kind of bush management organisations in Australia do have large roles for Indigenous communities, but I think that some ecologists in this case have been pointing out that we do need to engage more with Indigenous knowledge as a way of appropriately caring for country. But that's kind of, this is one part of broader environmental news going on in Australia at the moment. We've also had a report from some researchers out of ANU, UNSW and the University of Melbourne that for the first time they've been able to link a fossil fuel project to the individual deaths that are likely to occur as a result of the project. So doing a study into the effects of Woodside's Scarborough gas project off Western Australia, the study found that it would lead to 484 additional heat-related deaths in Europe alone this century and kill about 16 million additional corals on the Great Barrier Reef during each future mass bleaching event. So, yeah, I think this is a pretty groundbreaking piece of information, because usually when we're talking about the cost, the environmental costs of fossil fuel projects, we tend to be talking in aggregate terms and looking at kind of the macro effects. But this study has managed to actually quantify the real lives that are going to be lost as a result of this. So super interesting.
Yeah, and the I mean, it's good. They're appealing to European lives. So yeah. Hopefully makes the institutions care, I guess, in a really cynical way. You recorded some audio from an event at Woodside Monash that we're going to play.
Yeah.
We'll hear from Professor David Karoly. And then, what's her name?
Basha Yajman.
Yeah.
So, yeah, quite a few. So at Monash University, the university's Stop Woodside Monash campaign held an event with a bunch of experts and speakers advocating for the removal of Woodside from Monash's campus. They currently fund a building on Monash's campus and make financial contributions to Monash. So this discussion was about the kind of disastrous impact that the expansion of Woodside's project this year will have on the environment, and kind of essentially how dirty of a business and company Woodside is, and we should really not want to have anything to do with them as a country.
I'm going to start by acknowledging the Bunurong people on whose lands we are meeting now, because Bunurong country is part of, or should I say Monash University is part of, Bunurong country across southeast Nam. And when we talk about climate variations and climate change, the traditional custodians of the lands across Australia, the many different parts of the freshwater country, the saltwater country, and the land country across Australia, there is only one continuous Indigenous civilization which has survived from the last ice age thousands of generations ago, more than 60,000 years ago. They have lived sustainably and managed country, freshwater country, saltwater country, and land country through the change from the last ice age to the current interglacial period, relatively warm period. And they've survived and managed country through 5 degrees of global warming over 10,000 years. Port Phillip Bay used to have kangaroos roaming across what was the remnants of the Yarra River. And you could walk from Melbourne to Tasmania, as the Indigenous peoples did. They survived 100 metres of sea level rise, 5 degrees of global warming over 10,000 years. The only problem now is that there are some businesses like Woodside who want to accelerate climate change and global warming, not over 10,000 years. They want to continue to extract ancient fossil fuels like coal, like oil, and fossil gas, which they describe as natural gas, but it's fossil gas that they're extracting, and it will lead to rapid warming over the next 20 years and the next 100 years. What we know is that Woodside is keen to make profits, not keen to pay taxes, and wants to minimise the impacts on its profits. It is keen on greenwashing, which is hiding the impacts of their business on all people in Australia and all Indigenous communities. We know how to manage country if we listen and learn from the Indigenous peoples across Australia. We must not listen to the greenwashing that Woodside is sending as part of educational programs on the notional benefits and needs for fossil fuels in Australia. The only need we have to make is to stop extracting 50 million year old fossil fuels from underground, exposing them in the atmosphere, accelerating global warming. Most people hear that carbon dioxide is the biggest contributor to global warming, and that is the case at present. Every time you burn oil, it produces more carbon dioxide. Every time you burn fossil gas, it releases and converts into carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is the biggest contributor to global warming for the next 100 years. But Woodside doesn't tell you that every ton of fossil gas that is extracted by Woodside and then leaks into the atmosphere is 80 times worse per ton than carbon dioxide for the next 20 years. Fossil gas extraction by Woodside is much worse for global warming in Australia and around the world. It's not caring about the impacts on global warming. It's caring about maximising its profits and digging up more fossil gas and selling it. The only problem with the current government that was elected with a climate action policy is the first climate action they did was to approve the North West Shelf Gas Processing Project as soon as they got re-elected. What that North West Shelf means and the extraction of gas and processing by Woodside is there's a law that the government approved through Parliament in 2022, a Climate Change Act, which set in law that Australia needed to have zero emissions by 2050. That would be fantastic, but it's too late, too slow, and not fast enough to limit global warming and prevent the adverse impacts. So what we need to do is also recognise that the first action by the new federal government after they were elected in 2025 now makes zero emissions by 2050 in Australia impossible. Why? Because they've approved Woodside and the North West Shelf gas processing plant to be extended not till 2050, till 2070. And many of you will be still alive in 2070, I hope, and you will be experiencing the massive extra global warming due to the emissions from Woodside. So it's critically important that you all sign on to the Stop Woodside at Monash commitment now to prevent Woodside causing more global warming and presenting misinformation to school kids who get the information package on the values of fossil fuels. And the only value of fossil fuel is keeping it underground where it's been for 50 million years. That's where it needs to stay. And you need to sign that Woodside needs to, and Monash needs to stop the Woodside partnership immediately this year. Thank you.
I do want to acknowledge that I'm going to be talking about my experience as a South Asian person, but while a lot of us do demand visibility and to be heard and to talk about intersectional climate justice, I want to acknowledge that there's really no justice without Indigenous justice, and we are meeting on stolen land today. So I started in the climate movement in 2019. 350,000 people marched across this country and called for climate action. We skipped school, we did all of that. I spent so many hours in meetings, and I'm sure Karina, I know you did as well. And a lot of us still do that. And instead of actually listening to us or taking into account, you know, what we're calling for, I think Monash decided to enter into the partnership with Woodside like at the very end of 2019 or at the start of 2020. So it's just a bit like, I don't know how that happened. And it's the same with the government. the government has continued to approve new fossil fuel projects. In May this year, our wonderful new Environment Minister Murray Watt approved Woodside's Northwest Shelf Gas Project. Shame! And this not only produces an eye-watering amount of emissions, but also sits next to what is considered as the most significant Indigenous rock art in the world. And Murray Watt was there lobbying against the recognition of it as a World Heritage Site. Luckily, it did get World Heritage recognition, and hopefully we can actually move forward and make sure that it's protected. But this site is so, so important. And just days before receiving approval, Meg O'Neill, the CEO of Woodside, Australia's largest independent dedicated oil and gas company, said she basically blamed it on young people. She said that instead of looking at fossil fuels as bad and renewables as good, we need to think about our consumption because we're on sites like Timu. So instead of actually thinking about the systemic impact that corporations like Woodside have, apparently it's our fault because we're on Timu and Shein. And none of this is about ideology, because young people like myself, and I feel like most people here, do actually recognize the impact on carbon emissions. Just this morning, I was chatting to somebody about flights, and oh my gosh, should I take the 12-hour, 13-hour train ride to Sydney instead? And it's those kinds of conversations that we're forced to have because corporations like Woodside think that what they're doing is actually for the good of the country. And what's really interesting is that Market Forces did some analysis, and they found that to reach Woodside's current emissions, it would take every single young Australian purchasing 4,888 t-shirts per year. So that's the level of impact. Each of us here would have to buy almost 5,000 t-shirts. And a 2017 report found that 70% of carbon dioxide emissions worldwide come from just 100 companies. And since 1988, just 100 companies have been responsible for 71% of the emissions. Shame. And now there's so many statistics out there, and I could just keep regurgitating all this incredible data that we have. But I think a lot of the time, these stats actually take out the human impact, because climate change actually affects us as individuals in our daily lives. Over the last few months, we've actually heard about the floods in Australia. And of course, we had bushfire season 2019, 2020. We've heard about the floods in Florida and, of course, the heat waves in UK. But what about the unbelievably hot heat waves in India and Pakistan in 2024 and 2025? These heat waves that usually start in May and June began in April with record-breaking temperatures. And these conversations about impacts in South Asia are generally left behind. People seem to think that if it's affecting Europe or Australia or the US, it's front and center, it makes the media headlines. But what about the rest of the world? South Asia is one of the most climate vulnerable regions. And the Australian Defence website actually says that more than 750 million people in South Asia have been impacted by one or more climate related disasters in the past two decades. So the Australian government's clearly aware of what they're doing. Last month and the month before, India and Pakistan were demolished by floods. In just 2 days, 307 people died and 23 were injured in Pakistan. There's several missing in the region of Kashmir. And Pakistan's Disaster Management Authority actually estimated this year's monsoon season to be 65% more intense than last year. And that's purely because of climate change. And similarly, in India, they've said that that's what's happening with these heat waves, that they are being fueled by climate change. And so my mom grew up in Bengaluru, a city in India, which she said used to be called the Garden City. I've been there a few times, and I don't know if I'd call it that anymore. Every time I visit, the heat is much stronger, the air feels dirtier, and all this is air pollution and climate change, and corporations like Woodside constantly putting their interests and short-term profits over people across the world. And my favorite memory going to India is actually this amazing cultural museum called Janapada Loka. And it's really pretty, tall, lush trees, like grass fields, everything. And I remember it being there with my cousin when she was 3. And now when I think about going to India and when I think about going to that site, I'm always like, I wonder if it's still there, because India has faced so many climate impacts and much of this is just not seen. And I worry about, you know, my 12-year-old cousin now growing up breathing that air that is being polluted by these large corporations. And if Bengaluru was a garden city and had all that lush greenery, what does it mean for the rest of India? And I know that these communities in India and Pakistan and Afghanistan actually contribute the least to climate change but are affected the most, and their voices need to be part of the conversation when we talk about corporations like Woodside. It's not just Australia that's facing the impact, but you can actually see the solidarity between Indigenous communities here and in India as well, who have been resisting corporations like this for decades. But what it tells us is a fossil fuel industry is a colonial project. It's creating divisions with communities and destroying Indigenous land, claiming to create jobs and cheapen our energy bills, when we know that the cheapest energy will not be coming from fossil fuels. And despite this, Woodside has found its allies in the Murdoch media, the government, and apparently institutions like Monash, which decided to partner with Woodside in the name of sustainability. Let's move forward and create more gas. And Woodside is supported by myths and points of deflection like Meg O'Neill, who blame young people, and the narrative that Australia's emissions don't really matter because India and China don't understand environmentalism. But environmentalism in India actually dates back to decades ago with the Chipko movement, where they were known as the tree huggers because they were trying to stop deforestation. And it really does come to us, unfairly, but rightly so, that we break these myths and recognize that countries like Australia and the institutions in Australia, like this university, have a big responsibility to lead the transition to renewables and not proudly talk about their partnerships with fossil fuel companies. And if anything, after graduating from a 5.5-year long law degree from USID, I can say that I wish I was more proud to say that I went to USID, but with their own investments in fossil fuels, with the repression of protest on campus, I can say that it feels a little bit embarrassing. And I feel like a university like Monash, which actually did announce divestment in 2016, but has clearly backtracked, they probably want their students to feel proud about attending this university, calling themselves an alum. And as Amanda said, universities have been central for protests and activism, shaping minds and fostering progress. A partnership with Woodside is literally the antithesis to that. All I can say is that, you know, this turnout right here is clearly something to be proud of, and that building there isn't. I get that it's sustainable, but also we can take the name out. So that's all I want to say, and thank you so much for listening.
3CR Community Radio, giving voice to the community since 1976.
solidarity, Becky Team listener, when injustice, more sharp than a viper's tooth, as the bard declared, injustice, the greatest injustice ever, ever, poor Donald. U.S. of the U.N. of the U.S. of the world, big supremo Donald Trump of the poor, denied the Nobel Peace Prize, denied the well-earned opportunity to join, for instance, Menachem Begin, leader of the terrorist Stern Gang, which cost the Palestinian non-land, non-people their land, Henry Kissinger, Vietnam War warmonger, Barack Obama, murderer of Afghans and Pakistanis at will. His trained killers press a button in the Pentagon and whoopee, another drone slaughtering the bad guys like wedding parties. Great men of peace all, and Donald would be so at home in their company. Such altruistic, selfless company. But no. Despite the bitter, unjustified disappointment, Donald pushed on in his quest for world peace by bombing and killing more Venezuelans on the high seas in his campaign against presumably fishing, while his disappointment was assuaged ever so slightly that the prize did go to a woman who, like Donald, is bent on overthrowing the Venezuelan government because the Venezuelan government refuses to bow and scrape like all the other lackeys, including our very own big supremo, Anthony Albanese. But worse, it favours the poor, the workers over the rich. Shame, Venezuelan government, shame. To compound the evil, big supremo Nicolas Maduro described the woman of peace as a demonic witch. Imagine how Donald's sensitivity would be abraded by someone using that sort of language. What choice has Donald but to pursue peace through his Department of War by sinking the Venezuelan fishing fleet and plotting the overthrow of this anti-caring business-class government? Donald also threatened to pursue peace by turning the Department of War on the non-land, non-people unless they throw down their arms and come up with bodies which may well be under the rubble, along with thousands of non-people bodies. The rubble resulting from Donald and Benjamin's bombs, with the troubadours he parts, troubadours he doesn't supply, after Donald and Benjamin were good enough, caring enough to provide a ceasefire plan, knowing there was no need to consult the non-land, non-people anyway. For goodness sake, how do you consult non-people? A balance maintained by that giant of an objective fifth estate, Lord Rupert of Wapping. His Wapping Sin P1, twins tears of joy after 738 days of hell, release from dungeons of torture. Fair enough. Other than Lord Rupert's renowned unbiased coverage might have looked a little more unbiased if a week earlier he had also screamed at the illegal imprisonment of peace activists hijacked on the high seas and held by Lord Rupert's very close friend Zion in torturous conditions. Six pages of the horrors faced by Zion hostages were balanced by two columns devoted to thousands of non-land, non-people held illegally by Zion. The neutral tone expressed in the headline, High Price as Monsters Also Celebrate Deal. The article detailing how monstrous are these monsters, the non-land, non-people, all monsters. Lord Rupert, knowing there is no truth in one person's enemy, is another person's freedom fighter. The socialists went to this year's election promising to increase taxes on the huge superannuation balances of the filthy rich of the filthy rich. And this week, big economic guru Jim Chalmers' charmed capital, by announcing the government would carry out a bit of a promise, extracting heaps less from the filthy rich of. Jim looking not all that happy, but overruled by Anthony. Anthony, there are many policy areas, benefits for terra-nullius, non-land, non-people, other taxes, a republic, for instance, where you tell us you can't take action because you didn't promise them. So why not keep one of the promises you did make? We are a government that listens to people and consults people, and the filthy rich of made it clear there were serious flaws in the original plan. Like what? Like that had to pay lots of tax. So the filthy rich of, explained, taxing the filthy rich of was bad for the filthy rich of. Exactly. Oh, well, that explains that. And that's good for the economy, unlike the real threat to the economy, highlighted yet again, as if we needed to be reminded, after aluminium giant Al Choker the Air announced it will close its Kwinana refinery in Western Trubnawasi, sacking, or sorry, sadly having to let go, 220 workers. We appreciate the dedication and support of our Kwinana workers, Al Choker said, which will make them feel so much better. But the reminder, Western Trubnawasi Hayseed and Sheepshit Party Supremo, bloke called Shane Love, displaying his love for those workers, fingered the problem. Western Trubnawasi's resource industry is under siege from red and green tape, heavy-handed industrial relations, changes, and a socialist-driven push for unionisation that is driving up costs and eroding investor confidence. There. No satire required. The problem in a nutshell. Or a nut's head shell. Investor confidence is so fragile, isn't it? Threatened by all that environmental green tape, when all that environmental green tape simply slows down the inevitable approval, and by caring business class relations changes like pay and conditions, and worse, evil unions. The delicate flower that is the economy is so delicate. Yet, in another carefully researched analysis, the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin this week ran a series on how difficult it is to do business in Victoria, with caring employers complaining how difficult it is to recruit staff because workers could earn more in the public sector. Now, we might have thought there was a pretty simple solution to that, but apparently not. Hopefully none of them will be earning, the workers that is, earning too much soon if they really, really care about the economy. The Reserve Losses Bank Assistant Governor and Chief Economist Sarah Hunter, real name, says workers will have to accept lower wages, lower wage rises for the good of the economy and the country, which are the same thing. See, unless they accept lower wages, they will stoke inflation, that is, caring employers increasing their prices. So the problem lies fairly and squarely with lazy, avaricious workers and evil unions. We can't expect caring employers to take a cut. That would hurt all of us. Wonder if Sarah is recommending a cut in her own salary. Caring employers can't take a cut, but they can take corporate welfare, but only because they know that too is good for all of us, with the latest round of bailouts estimated to cost $1 million for every job saved. We raised the $600 million smelter handout to Glenn Rotten to the core last week, whose 13 Trubnawasi coal mines and other mineral resources haul in more than $14 billion revenue, on which it meets its legal tax obligations by paying not 1 cent. $600 million from those who can't not pay tax. Well, another international pollution behemoth, Rio Tinto the Planet, wants $1 billion in corporate welfare for its Tomago aluminium smelter. Money well spent, because it could use it to blow up a few Terra Nullius non-land, non-people sacred sites. On a positive note, inspired proposal by the Institute of Public Very, Very Private Affairs, how our state government could rake in an extra $290 million a year. See, we're building all these prisons to appease Lord Rupert of Wapping, not that that doesn't stop him attacking the socialists day after day, and the Institute says we could lease out all those empty cells to states with overcrowded prisons. Genius, really. But we reckon the idea should be extended to solving the housing crisis altogether. Win-win. On Great Minds, the giant technology mind of the week award to Northern Victorian state caring business class party MP Wendy Love, hell, what have I done, who sent an email to thousands of her constituents welcoming them as new Trubnawasi citizens, which came as a huge surprise to thousands of people born in Trubnawasi who thought they were Trubnawasi citizens. Whoops! The caring business class party said most people didn't even know who she was, but will now. Well, yeah, and they'll admire her intelligence. Wendy, your Giant Technology Mind of the Week Award is on its way. And still on giant caring business class party minds, if we wondered why there were those long, long queues outside bookshops this week, the answer is simple. Former Big Supremo Tiny A Bit More for the Boss's new tome, True Blue Aussie, A History. Guaranteed to be history, but bearing little relationship to the story. And we can be sure Tiny's history starts at 1788. Indeed, he said this week, oral history is unreliable, so we can't confirm claims about frontier wars, about massacres. Tiny's no doubt academic research is also screening on Lord Rupert's No Facts Tell Lies pay TV channel, and notice SBS Telly is also running a series about True Blue Aussie, and no idea how accurate or objective it will be, but we can guarantee which one will be more accurate. A 700-page tome biography of a tiny predecessor, Little Johnny Howhard, written by a couple of acolytes, reportedly sold 20 copies nationwide. Wonder if Tiny's literary contribution will match that. Historical revisionism, that mob who advertised expensive coins and statues and tributes to train, killing and royalty, advertised this week yet another silver commemorative coin. We are proud of every Vietnam veteran. Didn't realise I was or we were young, ignorant cannon fodder. I am proud of the young 20-year-olds who had the courage and intelligence to refuse to join yet another illegal USO invasion with True Blue Aussie swinging along on its coattails. We await a commemorative coin to the brave young draft resistors and conscientious objectors. Finally, all that green tape unnecessarily delaying adding cost to all those goods for all of us pollution projects. As the Minister for Pollution Projects, Murray Swatz, the environment, works on his new environmental protection laws, hope no one would dare to suggest they are actually pollution protection laws. No, no. Murray has been consulting the polluters and has handed the mining companies draft extracts to make sure they are happy with his proposals, which he says will speed up pollution approvals and protect the environment. We look forward to seeing how. And he says he is close to an agreement with the Caring Business Class Party Hayseed and Sheepship Coalition to support his bill, which means we know who and what will be paying the bill. And Murray will achieve what Anthony put him there to achieve. Well, the economy must come first. Good morning.
Good morning, Kevin. As always, insightful, satirical take on the week that was. Before that, we heard Nusantara Beat, this incredible Indonesian band that I'm obsessed with, playing their song Temat live, which I recommend everyone go check out. We're coming up to the end of the program. We got a report that Karina, or a recording that Karina recorded outside of the Snap Action at the public housing. I hope you enjoy the MC as much as I did when I was editing this down.
Well, welcome to the first ever rally at One Spring Street. Yes. Why are we here? We got anything better to do? One Spring Street, it just happens to be the office of one Harriet Ching, Minister of Housing, who, I don't know if you've heard about this, has scheduled the demolition of 44 public housing towers, which will leave 10,000 people displaced. And then they go, well, surely you've got documents, you know, to prove this. Why they have to be destroyed? She goes, yeah, I'm not showing you. He or she, where are the documents, Harriet? Oh, they've fallen down the back of a cupboard, and we've tried to get them with the broom, but, you know, well, what can you do? They should at least release the documents. We should expect transparency from the government. So they need to, if they're going to displace so many people, damn it. And this is good on you here, because are we aware it's anti-poverty week this week? I don't want to get political, but is there a class war going on, you know, where the rich are trying to force the poor out of their homes? I don't want to get conspiratorial or anything, but the fight back is good. But yeah, very interesting. But we have some speakers. This this person, the first speaker, really not easy to organise. I said to her, it's Jeannie Ersig. I said, can you please speak? And she said, at the rally, she goes, what's in it for me? And I go, nothing. She goes, look, I don't get out of bed for less than a cappuccino and a toasty every day. So I've bought her a cappuccino and a toasty to speak. Jeannie Ersig, what can you say about her? Yeah, to misquote Shakespeare, though she be small, yet she be fierce. Please welcome.
Oh yeah, I'm Jeannie. I have been a public resident for the past 30 years. I was at Bank Street Paran for 24 years in a group of public housing units, 120. They demolished them to make way for half of them were community units, half of them were private rentals. Any public housing? No. So then I was relocated to Barrett Beacon. I was there for 4 years. And the same thing has happened, that it's been demolished and now they are rebuilding. There will be 130 community units. There will be about 300 private units. And is there any public housing? No. So I believe that we should follow officers' idea, which is we should retain, repair, reinvest. So we should not demolish public housing. We should keep it, not demolish, repair, retain, reinvest.
I thought I didn't think Jeannie would get so political. She was really raising the rabble in the crowd there. I thought she'd give a recipe for toasty sandwiches, but no, she's got me. Wow, I was really sitting on the fence politically, but I think I've just been radicalised by that speech. Yeah, that was good. Jeannie used to live at Barack Beacon. Fun fact. This bit of canvas here is one of the old blinds from Barack Beacon, from one of the houses they were trying to destroy. So we're using their destroyed property that they've taken from us back as an attack. That's art. That's what art is. Breaking the law! Breaking the law! In the law. Now, this next guy, you know him, you love him. Oh man, I'm very excited to welcome to the stage. Oh, this bit of concrete. I give it up for the one, the only, Mr. Purple Penguin.
Thanks, Darth. Before I start, I just want to note that we're meeting on stolen land. And acknowledge Elvis past, present and emerging, and also I guess speaking of stealing land, today we're standing outside the office of a government that announced it'll demolish every single public housing tower in Melbourne, a decision that will uproot thousands of people and completely gut our public housing stock. The plan was announced without the evidence that we deserve, but we do know the reason why, and that's because there's not a single report that'll show that demolishing every single public housing tower in the midst of the worst housing crisis in living memory is a sound decision. The only justification for these demolitions is the desire for profit at the expense of public housing residents and the expense of all of us. For this government to have a slightly different number in their budget when they go to an election next year, and for this government to stay in the good books of the property developers and the lobbyists who caused the crisis in the first place. This morning I stood with many of you in the Magistrates Court to support a resident who risked everything to stop these cruel pre-demolition works. Pre-demolition works that are going ahead despite community opposition, despite thousands of pages of testimony and evidence that says there's a better way, and despite the fact that residents still live in these fucking buildings. Shouldn't be charged with vandalism or whatever they've made up. Should be charged with heroic desperation. People are defending these homes because the government simply will not defend theirs. So today we're saying loud and clear to this government and to the housing minister, stop the demolitions, release the ports that you've shrouded in secrecy, and stop facilitating the greed of property developers with a smile on your face. All of us here will stand with residents in the courts, in the streets, and at every single hearing until this plan is ripped up and our public homes are protected. What we need is homes, not handouts to developers and their donors. Thank you.
Well, we have another speaker, with lived experience, with lived experience of the housing crisis and what you have to go to. Oh my God, she's so autistic, so excited to walk in this lady again. Go crazy, throw small children in the air as they walk in the stage. What is her name? Grace Bell!
Hello, my name is Grace. I rent a so-called affordable apartment at Dunlop Avenue in Ascot Vale. For anyone aware, the Dunlop Avenue development is the flagship project of the big housing build, with a mix of affordable and community housing. Homes Vic is our landlord, with a separate managing agent consortium, and a community housing provider Evolve acts as the body corporate for the entire estate. I stand before you today as the ghost of Christmas future, as a window into a grim housing future we can still improve. Moving into a Homes Vic new build has turned into a nightmare we are trapped in, instead of the safe, accessible modern homes that are being promised as replacements after demolition. These problems are not isolated to one site. Like the managed neglect present in the older buildings, this is a symptom of a rotting housing system that prioritises line items over the well-being of community. Some of the highlighted issues that have been ignored by Homes Victoria in my building include mould, damp and waterproofing issues. Repeated mould testing has flagged multiple allergenic mould species and identified 26 Dunlop Avenue as a water-damaged building. We noticed signs of mould and water damage straight away when we collected the keys on the 1st of September 2023. We reported them and made formal complaints to the agent and Homes Victoria, but we've been dismissed, and the agents and Homes Victoria maintain there is no mould at all. A toilet cistern swab taken in December 2023 showed extremely high mould growth with severe risk from mycotoxins. Reports recommended use of PPE and limiting time spent in the area. Yes, in my only bathroom. Ventilation in the bathroom is completely inadequate. The bathrooms have no windows, and with the doors closed and extraction fan on, humidity in the bathrooms reaches the high 90s during a shower. But you can't easily leave the bathroom door open. If you're standing in the shower, you can make eye contact with the neighbours on the balcony in the building next door. Stachybotrys, or toxic black mould, was flagged in two separate tests, in a lounge room air sample in January 2024, and on a swab taken inside our kitchen extraction fan in May 2024. All air testing showed elevated hyphal fragments, which are growth structures of mould, similar to roots. Readings above 10 signpost a risk of an active mould colony growth. We had readings as high as 113 in one of the bedrooms. In the internal fire stairwell closest to my apartment, with no external walls, water drips down the walls between two floors, with puddles of rust seeping out from the bottom of the stairs. In the ground floor garage, cracks in the walls and ceiling get wet and drip down into the foundation during the rain. In one area, stalactites have formed in the ceiling cracks that have eroded through metal ducts and damaged the paintwork of the car unlucky enough to be parked below the worst of it. The car owner was told to use a car cover when parking in the internal garage, and none of the supposed fixes have stopped the drips. Other neighbours have had different issues. In the first 12 months, at least three apartments in the estate have had significant water leaks from their ceilings. One neighbour had no working air conditioner or heater during her whole entire lease. She was told not to use it as the external unit was damaged during installation and the original electricians had folded mid-construction, so no one knew whose problem it was. In the appeal unit of a building inspector who visited at the end of 2024, the waterproofing of our bathroom is not up to code. In the opinion of a building inspector who visited end of 2024, the waterproofing of the bathroom is not up to code. It requires a total redo, likely not isolated to our apartment. The gutters are not equipped for a 1 in 100 year storm. The overall drainage around the building is inadequate and in some places, again, was defined as not up to code. There's moisture in the walls and the skirting board around the windows in the common hallway. Security is conspicuously absent in our building. The external doors, including the garage, were locked open for days or weeks as the fob system was unreliable. Multiple residents have been locked out when a fob has malfunctioned. Officially advised of system-wide software issues in October 2024, I quote, "Rather than have everyone stuck inside, the doors need to remain open to allow renters to enter and exit." Neighbours have reported ongoing malfunction with the doorbell systems, which create an accessibility challenge for residents with limited mobility who rely on the ability to let support people in. Access to the communal garden is either through the steeply sloped side entrance of Building 26, which needs a fob, or up a flight of stairs, so limited access for anyone with mobility issues. Affordable housing residents are segregated from community housing residents, We're not invited to participate in community programs such as the welcome barbecues or formal garden opening events run by Homes Victoria and Evolve. And there's no integration between buildings and different types of residents. There's small differences in even things like the amenities available to the different buildings. For example, in the affordable housing buildings, we get dishwashers. The community housing buildings, for reasons unknown, get no dishwashers. Applying to the affordable housing ballot was a hope for a secure home backed by the government without having to navigate the public housing list or the social housing services who wouldn't even answer our calls. Instead, it's ruined my life, destroyed my belongings, and pushed me further into a pattern of housing insecurity. This is not a future I would wish on anyone, which is why I support the plan for retrofitting the existing buildings to as new condition. We need homes that will stand for a lifetime and not just an election cycle. Thank you.
Let's get to it like it is. Just hearing that, I'm sort of thinking maybe the whole system needs to change. I was thinking, the system's fine. It's getting by, but listen to that. No, it needs to change. Damn it, houses, they should be for people's needs, not corporate greed. We all know that. We all know the slogans. It's a human right. Good on you. And you spoke during the inquiry. Do we all watch the inquiry? I was like impressed by so many different speakers. Kevin Bell, the human rights lawyer, who was just saying, it's an affront to people's dignity to sort of like, turf them out of their house and not even explain why and release the reports. He was one of my favourite people. Who spoke, one of my least favourite people, was this lady, Harriet Ching. Boo! In the bin. Harriet Ching. Good on you. If there's any other speakers, what I'd be keen to do, hang around. We have a housing meeting next Thursday happening at Capitol Theatre. Kate Shaw has just dropped off 2,000 flyers for me to pass out, and I'll probably hand them out in the next 10 minutes or so. At the way I'm going, or Jim's going to step up. There is a little house which, if people, I'm kind of keen to sort of hang around here. We'll conclude the speech. But kind of keen to hang around and work a little tiny house if people are feeling their need to get uncrafty. But is there anyone else who would like to speak? It's Amelia!
Hey guys, well done for putting this on. I wasn't planning on speak, but hearing everyone else speak, I thought I might as well, and it's important. So, for those who don't know me, I am a rank and file member of the CFMEU, so I work in the construction industry. Construction workers want jobs that are safe and unionised and that benefit other working class people. We want to build hospitals, we want to build schools, and we want to build public housing. Governments like our Labor government and the Liberal government before them constantly try and blame workers like us for the housing crisis, when we know that the housing crisis is a symptom of their policies. And then they get workers to carry out their dirty work for them. They don't like to get their hands dirty, do they? Often it's perceived that construction workers are really well paid and homeowners and are not affected by the housing crisis, but that's definitely not the case. Me, myself, I'm a single mum and I have to rely on the private rental market. And having gone through private rental after private rental, there is never any security in it. The conditions are abhorrent, and you're beholden to the will of a real estate agent who doesn't even follow the own legislation that they're meant to follow. I've lived in houses without heating, without working ovens, with mold, with collapsing ceilings, and there's never anything done about it. But anyway, thank you all for coming out.
Welcome back. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Toby and Anila. We're coming to the end of the show today, so we'll just finish up by letting you guys know what's coming up in the community that you guys can get involved in, take action.
And just a correction, it was recorded by Zan from Uprise Radio. Sorry, Anila, yeah.
No, that was very useful information. Thank you, Toby. So coming up on Thursday at 6 p.m. on the 23rd of October, we've got the Standing Together for Public Housing rally coming up. Toby, you've got some events you wanted to announce?
Yeah, on Friday, Philef is having a movie night at 6:30 at Democritus, 583 High Street, Northcote. All donations will still be going to Olive Kids. And on Saturday morning, Free Palestine Melbourne are putting on how to translate international obligations into concrete actions, a campaign strategy day at AMU. That's 251 Queensbury Street, Carlton North, on the Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. So if you thought that the union movement could get involved, go and be part of the conversation. Don't just sit on your online platform and complain. That's all for us this week. We'll see you next week with Annie on the hot seat. We'll go out with Boko Ute, 9 to 5. I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to, I need a 9 to 5, I need a 9 to.
Listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.